I'm happy to introduce our speaker for this afternoon, Ron Stalsfus, and thankfully he has the title of his talk right up here for me. He's going to be speaking on reporting public pension liabilities, what every citizen ought to know. I think probably most of you know Ron, but let me do the introduction anyway. Ron's been on the faculty here. He's a professor of accounting in the business department. He's been on the faculty here since 1984. It's an interesting year to start your career. I'm trying to think of a good George Orwell quote, but he's one of our very valued faculty members. He's got an impressive record of publication and a number of peer-reviewed articles in accounting journals, along with some important conference publications. He's an outstanding teacher. Our accounting students do some pretty marvelous things. And he's a great servant of the EMU community. He's been on, just since I've been here, he's been on Faculty Senate, he's been on the Faculty Status Committee, he's been co-director of the MBA program. And I know this will embarrass him, but I think he's one of our stars. So I'm very much looking forward to what he's going to be talking about today. He was on sabbatical last year studying this very important topic, and I had the good luck to bump into him at lunch once or twice and hear about the work he was doing. But I think the importance of the topic is just driven home to all of us relatively recently when Detroit went bankrupt for the very reasons he's going to be talking to us about today. So, Ron, welcome.
Thank you, Fred, and I'm delighted to be here. You'll have to excuse my cold. I have fighting a bad cold. But I am really passionate about this topic, and I want to start by saying thank you for the opportunity, first of all. I need to thank the administration, the Faculty Status Committee, and particularly our department. It's really difficult for a small department to let somebody go for a whole year and have coverage, and it worked very well, and I'm extremely happy about that. I became interested in this topic during one of my classes in advanced accounting. We have a segment of governmental accounting. And I was aware that a new standard was coming for reporting pensions. So I started digging around Harrisonburg City's annual report. And in the notes, it's buried very deeply in the notes. You just really don't have access to these numbers very well at all. Harrisonburg City is somewhere around $38 million of unfunded pension liability. Harrisonburg City. And unfunded and unreported, I would add. It's not in the financial statements. At the same time, our net assets, and for governmental accounting, you call them net assets instead of equity, so it's the assets minus the liabilities, is about the same number. So there's a new standard coming in 2015 that says all of these are going to be coming onto the balance sheet. So I'm thinking, here's Harrisonburg City, pretty fiscally conservative. We're going to basically be done. I mean, financially. I mean, it's gone. So, you know, there's my interest. And I'm thinking, you know, what happens if Harrisonburg's done that? So I put in a proposal to do public pensions, and I examined all 50 states and their public pension plans and had a good time doing that. Honestly, I did. You might not believe that, huh? Okay, so how do I get this to advance? There we go.
Yeah, it
worked.
It just lacked focus.
All right. It lacked focus. That's a good technical term. Thank you, Jack. I'd like to introduce my co-researcher in absentia. This is Dr. Ruth W. Epps from Virginia Commonwealth University. She's a great co-collaborator and a great co-researcher. It's been good to work with her. She's also an expert in governmental. So I want to talk about this research, but I think first there's a more interesting, compelling story that I need to tell. This is the research over here, and we'll get to it a bit later. But the interesting story to me is Here's my whole speech right here. And this is a really a great cartoon, you know, because you can see here the returns and the contributions are dribbling into the trust funds and the payments are just gushing out. And, you know, this is one way that you can visualize this problem. You know, we could say that Detroit maybe figured it out. Just turn the spigot shut, right? Don't pay all those promises. But, you know, there was a quote in the Wall Street Journal that said, you know, we're all Detroiters. This is really our Social Security system as well. I mean, so this is an important piece and a pertinent topic to understand. And my particular interest is in is on the government entities of these. So I'm looking particularly at governmental entities. So today I want to look talk about review pensions and current reporting standards. I want to talk about Virginia's defined benefit retirement plans. We also have something called a defined contribution. They are far less controversial because you make a decision to make a contribution, make the contribution, and your obligation's over. The defined benefit plan is a very different vehicle. It says something like this: I'm going to pay you some factor, let's say 2%, for every year that you work. So if I work 25 years times 2%, that's 50% of my ending salary. And I'm going to get that for life with COLAs, with other. So it's no risk on my part. I mean, no worries on my part unless you live in Detroit. And then talk about the new reporting standard, and then finally maybe some more there. Defined benefit is really this very complex time value problem. We are looking at promises today that we're going to pay out years and years and years down the road. And the accounting challenge is really is how do we value or how do we recognize the current cost for those future promises? All right, so that's the challenge that we have in an accounting sense and in a funding sense. The GASB 27, the GASB is the Governmental Accounting Standards Board, discusses three different types of pension plans, and these are all defined benefit types. One, and excuse me, this is a bit technical, but I think you need to understand the big picture. Single employer defined benefit plan is simply a place where, did that move? It did. I can't read all my notes here. A single employer defined benefit plan is a single employer and a single plan. So it's pretty clean, it's pretty neat. It's typically in Virginia, it would be the state police, the judges, you know, maybe to quote Orwell, the more equal among us, if you're a state worker. The agent multiple employer plan would be multiple employers that pool investing resources. So you have maybe one investment group, investing group that does the research on the investments, but they do keep separate the obligations of each municipality, of each governmental unit. And that kind of makes some sense. Cost-sharing plans are really a cost-sharing multiple employer defined benefit plans are where, in my view, we see some pretty interesting, I'll say at this point, things going on. Here you have all of the employers of this group sharing equally, all right? So you share everything. You share the resources, you share the benefits, and you have a system that is very communal, right? So it's very communal. Single employer and agent multiple plans, the actuaries measure the annual required contribution. We call that the ACR. And this represents the normal cost. And the normal cost you can think of in a number of different ways. But as an employee works one more year, you get the extra 2%, right? So you have also maybe some better information about the ending estimate of the ending wages and all of that. So the normal cost really represents those things from year to year. You're moving towards maturity, so to speak. And what you're doing is you're adding more cost to that. So the actuaries, we rely very heavily on actuaries in this business. So you have what's called the annual required contribution. The employers, get the difference here, the actuaries measure that. The employers report the annual pension cost. The annual pension cost, if it equals the ARC, it's pretty clean as well because you have met that requirement and you have no further liabilities. If, on the other hand, the governmental unit fails to pay the ARC, you have this gap, and the gap is reported as a net pension obligation, NPO, as we call it. And any NPO that you see on a financial statement is going to represent the cumulative differences over the year. Now, if you think about this difference here, it is actuarially based. So in a sense, when you have either a single employer or a multiple employer plan, an agent multiple employer plan, you are saying and you are reporting any funding deficiencies. There's still an awful lot of room for what we call earnings management, because when you look at smoothing some of these things, you can smooth off, you can smooth out differences over 10 to 40 years. There's six different ways to calculate normal cost. So, you know, what's in your favor kind of thinking? Looks to me like we see some of that. The majority of teacher and state worker pension plans are in this cost-sharing multiple employer category. It's a single plan, pooled resources, participating employers, risk, rewards, cost, benefits are all shared. There's absolutely no incentive for Harrisonburg City to put more into that than they are required, because it's going to go straight to Virginia Beach or Norfolk or anywhere, right? So you kind of meet the minimums in this thing. And cost-sharing plans therefore use what we call a funding approach. And employers pay the required contribution rate to avoid any pension liabilities. And most employers will pay the funding rate. In theory then, if everybody's paying this funding rate and it's based on the actuary's recommendations, you would have a plan that can meet all obligations over time. All right? But paragraph 19, here's the kicker. Employers participating in cost-sharing multiple employer plans recognize annual pension expenses equal to their contractually required contributions to the plan. Employers recognize pension liabilities and assets as the difference between the contractually required and the actual. Yeah. By the way, in accounting, recognize means that it's recorded in the books, right? So who sets the contractual contribution rate? The contractual contribution rate, not the actuaries. It's our legislators. Oh, dear. Did I hear that? Oh, dear. Every state does this. Their legislators, who also, by the way, balance their books, right? Balance the state budget. Yeah. So it's a challenge. See, I told you you couldn't just eat one. We have a number of states that are severely underfunded. Connecticut, Illinois, Kentucky, Rhode Island have less than 55% funding in their trust funds. That is the present value of future payments versus what's in there. That's not the future payments. It's the present value of future payments. By the way, discounted at some very generous rates, as high as 8% I saw. 7.5% is fairly common. Oh, yeah. So what happens when you reduce that rate? What happens to that present value of that future liability? It just starts going through the roof. This is disturbing to me. It is. Wisconsin is the only state that has 100% funding. There are 34 states less than 80%, right? North Carolina, by the way, is at 95%, our neighbors to the south, a very strong example for us to think about. So, I think the reporting standards encourage state retirement system to invite employers into their system, right? So if I can become part of this cost-sharing multiple employer plan, then I am eligible for this very special accounting treatment. Yeah, good idea. And in fact, many states claim that they actually claim and say, we do pay the state teachers and we do pay a good chunk of municipalities' pension contributions. Virginia does it, but they don't quite claim it. I'm not sure what that means yet. Well, I have a hunch, but I'll keep that quiet for the moment. The presence of those additional employers really is what moves them from a single employer, all state employees, where you do have to use an actuarial approach that says my obligations are this, my contribution is this, and any underfunding gets reported. All right, so that's the big deal in my view. There's no current price to pay for deferring those contributions. It's not readily evident on the financial statements. You will find them, I found them, in the notes and in any trust funds that you can get public information on. I looked at all 50 states' annual reports, and I looked at all 50 states' trust fund reports as well. So I did a lot of printing, and I should thank our endowment fund for some sharing of costs for that. Each employer should report a schedule of funding progress and a schedule of employer contributions for the entire plan. So when Virginia does it, it's for the whole VRS. So when you see that, it isn't specifically for the state employees only, it's for the whole VRS. And each employer should disclose the information relates to the plan as a whole. So there's information out there. I want to make some observations about data. Connecticut was the only single employer state with single employer plans from top to bottom. So they are reporting at some level some obligations if they're not paid. Most states have combinations, right? Most states have combinations. And with that presence of local or other employers, you just can do, move into a cost-sharing plan and deal with contractual requirements and meeting contractual requirements. Why would such a pattern emerge? Well, you can almost guess, you know. That is the way states can balance a budget. There's no particular cost to doing that, apparently, but we're finding out differently. What about Virginia? Virginia has three single employer plans, the judicial retirement, Virginia law officers, and the state police, the more equal than others ones. The Virginia retirement system, the VRS, contains three multiple employer plans, state employees, state teachers, and political subdivisions. Here is something from the 2011 Virginia CAFR, which is the Comprehensive Annual Financial Report. The VRS's actuary recommended rates of 8.46%, 25.56, 15.93, and 46.79 to VRS spores, Virginia Labor and JRS respectively. The employer contributions by the Commonwealth, the contractual rates, were 2.13 versus 8, 7.76 versus 25, 5 versus 15, 28 versus 46. You know, the time value of money is great when you're investing, but it works against you as well when you're in debt. So we're digging this hole, and we're digging it pretty rapidly. You can't read this too well, but what you can see here, and what I think is important, this is the annual required contribution. This is what they contributed. You know, they contributed 46% in 2011, all right? And so the statutory requirement is 46%, which the last column is the important thing. The last column says we're not reporting any liabilities. We've done our duty. We're paid up, so to speak, at least in terms of the balance sheet. Virginia retirement system is the largest of the Virginia ones, and so that's kind of where I concentrate most. In 2012, Virginia did contribute 60% of the ARC, so it moved from 46 up to 60. Also here, Virginia reports nearly $24 billion in unfunded pension liabilities in 2011. Now, $24 billion would be the state, Virginia, state police, all the other ones, all combined. And the VRS includes teachers and municipalities. What's kind of important here also is this funded ratio. The funded ratio is the relationship between the actual assets and the present value of the future liabilities. So Virginia is at 74% in 2010. In 2011, it went down to 68, and it's headed still downhill, even with that increased contribution. Here is one of my favorite charts. This shows from 2001 up through 2011, what happened to the unfunded liabilities. Now, that is $23.9, almost $24 billion. What's reported on the state CAFR is about $2.8 billion, about that much right there. That's pretty sad to me. Now, this does include the state police, the political subdivisions, and I'm not sure what Virginia's going to do when the new standard comes into play. They're going to probably try to push all those costs down to the local school districts and the local municipalities, even though they do participate and pay most of that. Let me go back here. What makes me really sad right here? I'm an accountant. I enjoy my discipline immensely, but I'm very sad because I think some really poor accounting standards have seriously contributed to this problem. That is not hard for me to see. It's hard for me to say, though. That's not good work. I want to talk about the new standard, GASB 68, and this is a huge improvement in my estimation. And it becomes effective June 15th of this year. So we're going to see things change from here out. It does recognize in the, I'll call it the balance sheet, it's called really the statement of net assets, the unfunded liability using one cost method instead of six. It recognizes pension expenses much quicker than before. And it will recognize the entire difference between the actuarial present value of the projected benefit payments, that is total pension liability, and the trust fund equity. We're moving. For Virginia, state and local governments will record an additional $28 billion in unfunded pension promises. That's going to show up on the balance sheet. That's what I was talking about in Harrisonburg. It's going to take most of the unrestricted money. It's going to take it all. And so I think the wake-up call is coming. And by the way, when these standards were, when the GASB does standards, they're in full view of the public, and there's invited comments. And believe me, they got comments. How can we afford it? Well, somebody made a promise some time ago. The discount rate. I mentioned earlier that some of the states use discount rates as high as 8%. It has to be disclosed, so it's there. If your plan is severely underfunded, you're going to use a blended rate that says, I'm going to use my expected return on the investments as long as the money lasts, so you're making calculations out, and from there on, it's going to be public debt, all right? And so what's going to happen, the returns, the present value of those are going to really move up, and so the picture is even going to get worse. New standard attempts to more carefully match pension expense in the period in which the employee earns the benefits. That's should be the goal of any system. And it requires governments to true up the pension liability at each valuation. So we're going to be looking every year at the actuary's numbers, and we're going to say, all right, here's the liability. We're going to true up to that. The changes, as changes in the assumptions occur, that would be the mortality rate, the life, length of life, all of the insurance type estimates that you make. Many of these are going to require immediate recognition in the expenses. Prior to this, in GASB, the current standards, when you made a plan amendment giving more generous benefits, those were amortized over the future lives of all those people. So a legislator could be very generous at no cost. All right? You get the point that I'm kind of skeptical. Sorry about that. So expense recognition is going to be very, very fast. Normal and service costs will be, as always. Interest on total pension liability, if you are underfunded, you're going to get charged in interest. You're going to have changes in the benefit terms are going to come in immediately. And the projected earnings on the plans will be a reduction to that. So you have this pool of assets. You are projecting earnings. It's the projections are coming in rather than the actual. And that's okay in my view because it's going to smooth things a little bit. But the difference between expected and actual will be amortized over 5 years. Short. That's a short time. And so the new standard is really cranking up the control and the accountability of these plans. I should say, one of the things I think that kind of bothers me a little bit. I am actually a fan of pensions. You know, 15 years ago, we would have never heard anybody complain about a public pension. I shouldn't say that. Rarely would we have heard about that. And the reason is because most of us in our 401k plans were doing so well. It's not until we had 10 years of really bad markets that a lot of this discussion has come up. And I just account it to pension envy. You know, these guys, you know, these guys that lean on shovels all day, for example, you know, have this pension when they graduate, they get 80% of their ending salary for the rest of their life. It's probably not that generous, right? And it's probably not fair for us to think that way. I would be very concerned on the corporate side about pensions, partly because you never know kind of the length of life of the corporation, and they are much smaller numbers. When you're talking about a state system with the state employees, these are very large numbers. And the mortality and the expectations are much more normed, and you can get a much better read on all of these. When you have a small organization doing a pension, it would present a lot of risk to my thinking. So at the end of this, there are disclosures. You always have to describe the plan, who's covered. What's kind of new is all these changes. We're going to have to do a lot of analysis of the changes in pensions. So when you look at this, you can start to ask questions. Why is it changing? You get a lot more insight and depth into this. And we're also going to continue to do 10 years of information for the sources of changes of pension liability, the net pension liability, and the ratios that we saw up here earlier, and a schedule for actuarially determined or statutorily contractually required contributions and the related ratios. Cost-sharing plans is where we're going to see the big change. Remember, the single employer and the agent multiple employer plans were already reporting some liabilities. These cost-sharing plans now are going to have to take this great big pool of assets that covers all the teachers in Virginia, for example, or all the city workers in Virginia. They're going to have to take that pool and allocate it now. This is your part, and this is your part, and this is your part. And so Harrisonburg City School now is going to have their part on here. Did Harrisonburg City School have anything to say about the contribution rate they made? No. So I still owe the GASB a letter. It's based on their proportionate share. So, you know, you can do the math. You can say it's going to break down. into these smaller. In a sense, to me, it feels like they're making agency plans out of this, and maybe that would be a better model, even if they just did require that. So the real hard question for me comes about when you think about Harrisonburg School that now has to take from the VRS their portion of this unfunded liability and pop it into the financial statement, right? A big liability. So now we have the situation where the net assets are gone. What can Harrisonburg City do about it? I'm sure the city, the school districts, the city planners are not happy with that, but what do they do? If they contribute more to a cost-sharing plan, where does it go? I'm not sure that answers, that question has been answered. It hasn't been in my mind. So there's not much incentive to unwind the liability unless it's coming from Virginia, the state legislators. I have enjoyed this. I also think pensions are come about. The history of pensions is rather interesting. Back after the Great Depression, cities couldn't hire people, so they gave them pensions. They made promises that I had no idea how they thought they were going to pay, but they could hire people. And the governmental reporting was at that time, I'm responsible for the cash in, this is what we did with it. It was a very strong fiduciary model. So it didn't really take into account all those promises that you made. So we see a long history of pensions in the governmental sector. Some states also do not participate in Social Security. So this whole pension thing is wrapped up in their, it's their total retirement package. They can opt out of Social Security. I don't think they're Amish, but I think they can still do that, right? So now, I will talk briefly about the research that we did. It's probably more technical than I thought the story. I think the story about the legislators is really compelling, and it needs to be told, and needs to be told often. It's a little embarrassing, actually. So we looked at the bond yields, and we said bond yields link directly to unrecognized pension obligations. So we created a data set that had yield to maturity on bonds, and we regressed that against a lot of information. And one of the variables was this unfunded pension liability, and we found significance there. That's kind of the end result of the discussion. And our interpretation was that we interpret this to result to say that market participants recognize the unfunded pension obligations in increasing the riskiness of general obligation bonds. Duh. We would expect that. But why doesn't the accounting part do it then? I mean, so that's the drive for accounting is always to have meaningful information. And I think the presence or the upcoming new GASB standards is going to give a lot better information to creditors and investors in bonds. Any questions? Yes. I can see.
I have the mic here, so we're podcasting.
Ron, thanks. That was great. Here's my question. If you're looking at the unfunded component, and then you have concerns, and maybe your other fellow accountants do, it seems to me the biggest outcry ought to be from those potential recipients or beneficiaries. So why has that not been kind of the biggest outcry? And because they're the ones that stand to suffer, as in Detroit.
It will be interesting to watch because I suspect, I'm going to talk maybe Sandy can back me up on this. I wonder if teachers really understand it. I think they believe that it's going to be there, just like the Detroiters believed it was going to be there, and it's not an issue. It's an obligation of the good, fair credit of the state. And so they're not maybe not worried about it. But, you know, the judges called the allowed this on the table during the bankruptcy discussions in Detroit. Now, there was some quirk that did that, and I've been reading that other cities better not plan on that, but there was some variable in there that allowed them to do that. I sure hope it's on the table a whole lot more. It should be. I just don't know why there's why states, municipalities shouldn't have to have full funding when they make these promises. It will work if the funding is there. It will work. North Carolina, 95% funded.
Thank you, Ron. Excellent. The question I have relates to the discount rate applied to Virginia's unfunded pension liability. Did you at all attempt to readjust that for, say, a more modest discount rate?
No.
But if you did, it would, wouldn't it just make that?
It would get worse, for
sure.
It would
get a lot worse, yeah.
So all that we did is we looked at the published figures and said, this is going to be a proxy for what the new standard is going to pull in. So this was not terribly scientific. It's going to be, if anything, the pension expenses are going to be higher and the obligations are going to be higher.
Thanks a lot, Ron. My question is about VRS. I'm familiar with it because my wife teaches in the city schools, and I'm 63, soon to be 64, the same as her. And so we're doing some analysis, and we go to the VRS website, and we see what they're promising it will be. Well, I suppose there's some caveats with it, but for us, it's a promise.
Yeah.
And so how soon is that not going to be there?
When you turn 65. Do I need to make a change of assumptions?
I doubt it. I doubt it. Here's my hope for the new standard. This is going to rock the financial world of, well, I would argue that the market's efficient. I think the bond buyers already know that. Bond raters already know that. It's just that the citizens don't see it, so there's no kind of back pressure on the legislators to do something about this. And so citizens really, in my view, need to get involved in this and bring some correction.
I do have one other question. Who are you going to tell this to?
Anybody that listens.
Well, but who will listen that matters, that can do something?
I would love to get down into Obenchain's office. I haven't called to make an appointment yet. You know, the fun thing was I had a sabbatical, and then I started teaching, and my time just kind of disappeared. So I would love to show this to state legislators. I would. Anybody that listens, I said, I told many of you over lunch what I've been finding.
So, Ron, thanks again. You've made a compelling case that there's a crisis brewing with unfunded pension liabilities at the state and local level. And you kind of put off the table then the size of pension commitments that are made. And at the risk of appearing guilty of pension envy, I just want to raise an anecdote that I don't know if this is typical, but when I was executive director of a nonprofit 20 years ago, I hired a retired police officer. He had been with the police department for 20 years, retired full pension for the rest of his life, and what he got in his monthly pension payment was more than we could pay him full-time as a program director and about what I was making as an executive director. So he was doing fairly well.
1 month, more than your annual?
No. Per month, he was receiving more from his pension than I was receiving per month from my salary. And he just happened to share that with me one day. And so I did wonder, you know, is that really sustainable? After he worked for us, he went into another full-time job, so he basically had two pretty
salaries.
Decent incomes until he was 65.
Yeah.
Is that sustainable?
I don't think so. You know, I do hear people that complain here. I mean, I do hear them when they complain about public pensions. Partly because of the stories you hear. I suspect they're not as prevalent as we might think. But how'd we get there? I mean, that's the other issue that kind of is interesting to me. And again, I think it relates to maybe some strong unions, and I'm generally supportive of unions. It might be also that who's approving these ultimately. Again, it's our legislators that want to get reelected, right? So the danger of pensions is that they get out of hand, and particularly if there's no financial cost in the balance sheets or in the statements. See, this crosses political science, sociology, promises, theology. I mean, I don't know. That's, I guess, what got me a little excited about thinking about this, because this is such a cross-section of kind of revolving maybe around some really silly accounting reporting requirements.
This is probably a sociology question, but I was interested that Illinois is one of the worst states, and Wisconsin, right next door, is fully funded. They both have sort of similar political demography. What are the social consequences of those two different strategies? What was Wisconsin sacrificing in order to do that? What benefits were Illinois citizens getting because Illinois was doing the funny accounting?
Well, it could relate a little bit to the benefits side of that. I can't answer that in terms of benefits. The benefits might be more generous in Chicago or in Illinois. Right. Balance the budget, right? Well, you know, and in Virginia, we certainly cannot raise taxes.
That leads to my question. In my historical understanding of this, without an accounting background, it seems there's one of two things needs to happen. Either we'll start defaulting on our pensions, or taxes will have to raise to be able to meet these expenditures. That's correct, right? I mean, one of those two things will need to occur. And, right, so facing a legislator who, it's political suicide to raise taxes, especially if you're in a Republican-leaning state, doesn't that just force the latter?
It does. It does. Now, you also must know that nearly every state in the union has already changed their benefit package for new employees. In about 2010, everybody did that. And so as you look at state CAFRs and you start looking in the notes, you got plan one for those before then and plan two after. I think the legislators are also getting a pretty loud and clear message from this that, you know, don't give away the store, for goodness sakes. I like pensions. I just don't think that we have done a very good job of containing the benefits or making them more reasonable. And maybe that is a lost hope because of the electability of somebody that says no.
Ron, I just had a comment. One of the reasons, other than just watching the news regularly, that got me interested in Detroit is that you talked about tentacles and how this affects all these. Well, the Detroit Institute of Art
exactly
got involved in this because that's a valuable collection, part of which the city owns, part of it's privately owned. But the suggestion was thrown out, let's sell all the artwork and pay the pensions. Well, that hasn't quite happened, thankfully, in my opinion. But it's just really interesting to see the entanglement of how many different issues get involved looking for money in that case, I suppose.
They're working on some really creative solutions to that, and I forget exactly what they are, but they're making it a
bunch of private contributions, in part. Yeah,
that are going to buy the art for the institute, and that's going to spin off,
right?
And then that money can go and freely be used in the city. I hope that works.
Yay for art, huh?
You know, what's it mean when you make a promise? Yeah. That's the bottom line to me. What's it mean when you make a promise to a teacher that says, I'm going to do this for your pension, or a state worker?
I'm also wondering, do the legislators actually not know this?
I don't know.
Why do they need you to tell them?
I don't know.
That's unbelievable.
All right, now at the risk of just sounding overtly socialist, is there a way to make an argument? Your pension argument makes complete sense, that the larger the pool, the more sense a pension makes, because average lifespan starts to become average. Everything starts to norm itself. Does it make sense to push all states to get rid of state-level pensions and move to a more generous or aggressive Social Security plan across an even wider body of the entire country? I mean, that was certainly done with Social Security, right? In theory, we're all under a pension plan of sorts through Social Security. Does it make sense? I mean, at what level does the pain get great enough for states where they start to say, this would be better handled at a federal level to balance this? Because states are certainly going to be different, right? Different states are going to be hit by different economic crises or successes. I mean, North Dakota must be feeling very good right now. I would assume they can fund things pretty quickly all of a sudden. Other states are doing the reverse. Does that make sense? I mean, is there any... The political will is, I assume, what it will take, yeah. But... do you think this will become painful enough financially that it will start to look reasonable to people who would normally oppose such things?
Well, we have time. This is one of the good things. We just had 10 years of really bad markets, except last year, right? So we had a really long drought of returns. So they've reduced the benefits, and now we're starting to hit some good returns. And so that will help. But even in Virginia, and remember I said they increased the rate to 60% from 48, but still the unfunded ratio went down. I mean, it got worse, right? So I don't know how to answer your question on Social Security. It's, you know, the interesting one for me was Alaska was one of those states that opted out of Social Security. And then they also... did away with their defined benefit pension plan. So all of their new workers are on a defined contribution plan at their risk in the market and no Social Security. The Palin model.